listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. How much should we worry about inequality? With ongoing Corbyn mania in UK politics and the popularity of books like Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, it seems like we've never cared more about promoting equality of outcome. But is our concern justified? Is economic disparity a hallmark of modernity or a persistent feature of human civilization? On our podcast this week, Dr. Steve Davies, Head of Education at the IEA, and news editor Kate Andrews examine this controversial topic. As Steve explains, inequality and public concern about it has been a feature of societies around the world for centuries. They also challenge the commonly held view that inequality has been rising in recent years and examine whether people care more about some kinds of inequity than others. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.
Steve, inequality is a hot topic issue at the moment in politics in the UK, in the US, and in Europe and elsewhere. Is the focus on inequality being a problem in and of itself a new phenomenon?
No, not at all. In one sense, it's a continuous concern. Ever since the advent of modernity in the late 18th century, there have always been egalitarians who've claimed that there's too much inequality, that this is something problematic and that we need to do something about it. But it is true that the concern right now is higher than what you might call the continuing norm, but it's not unprecedented in this regard. We have gone through periods of intense anxiety about growing inequality before. For example, during what in the United States is known as the Gilded Age, the period after the Civil War, and particularly after the 1880s, there is considerable concern then about the growth of inequality. This comes to a head in both the United States and many parts of Europe, particularly the UK, during the 1900s, the Edwardian era, when there's huge concern about the enormous fortunes being made, not least in South Africa, by the so-called landlords, the people who had made enormous amounts of money in the gold and diamond mining industries in South Africa, while in the United States there's great concern about the so-called plutocrats, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Fricks, the Mellons, all the other people who'd made enormous fortunes during the aforementioned Gilded Age. Similar concerns also on the continent in late Tsarist Russia. So that period then, I think, is the one which is most like the one we're in now. It's at that time that you find a kind of level of concern about rising inequality that is on a par with the concern we have now.
And what was it that made those concerns die down?
Well, I think what happens is that eventually the perceived degree of inequality becomes less, and also maybe steps are taken to correct it. But actually, I think that's less important than an actual objective decline in the growth of inequality between certain people at the top end of the scale. It's worth asking at this point, well, why now? I mean, what is going on? And if you look at the actual statistics, you find that although there is a sharp rise in income inequality as measured by the Gini coefficient, the commonly understood measure for this, in the 1980s and early 90s in most developed countries, in most of the world since the early 1990s, income inequality has actually been fairly static. There hasn't been a significant increase in general income inequality or income differentials between the different deciles of the income distribution in the last 30 to 40 years.
Precisely. So why is there this perceived issue of income inequality as if it's constantly on the rise when here in the UK it's been stagnant for decades now?
Yeah, because I think it's always the case in some ways that it's the exceptional and unusual that gets more attention. So cases of what many regard as egregious, exaggerated, you know, remuneration or reward do tend to attract a lot of attention.
Fat salaries.
Yes, exactly. But there is a genuine phenomenon going on, which is that while the gap between the top 10% of the income distribution and the rest of the income distribution has not actually increased, the gap between the top 1% of the distribution and the 9% below them, the rest of the 10%, if you will, has grown quite dramatically, at least in Anglo-Saxon countries. In the Anglo-Saxon countries, the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, the Irish Republic, the top 1% of income earners have been pulling away from the rest of the income distribution. The share of total income going to the top 1% of the income distribution has increased quite dramatically in those countries. Not to anything like the same degree, interestingly, in continental Europe or Japan. So it's that perception that there's this very small number of people who, in terms of income anyway, are pulling away rapidly from everybody else. That's what is driving the concern, I think. And a lot of the concern comes, I think, not so much from the bulk of society, much less the bottom 10 or 20%, who, quite frankly, are too busy trying to, you know, keep things together to worry about this, but from the rest of the top 10 or 20% who are themselves doing very well, but who are quite often seriously irritated to notice that there's this very small number of people who are zooming away from them at the top. Now, that's exactly the same phenomenon that you also saw during the Gilded Age in the 1900s, when general income inequality, which was actually higher than it is now, by the way, quite significantly higher, did not get much worse, but the very top range of incomes, a very small number of people, the aforementioned so-called plutocrats, did indeed make enormous gains in both wealth and income and shot away from the rest of society. Now, the thing to mention is that that did not last. This is commonly explained as being because policy adjusted, but actually I think that's to get the chronological order wrong. I think the gap had already begun to narrow significantly before the policy shift took place. If you look at the period in the central part of the 20th century, when income and also wealth inequality diminished quite significantly, it's argued that this is due to government policy. But if you compare countries that have quite different policies, from very redistributed in some cases to hardly at all in others, what you'll notice is that almost regardless of the policy followed, there was a trend towards less inequality. Similarly, since the 1980s, the top 1% in many countries have been pulling away regardless of what policies the government follows. Now, what that suggests is that there's some kind of non-political factor which accounts for the growth in inequality at some periods, late 19th century, late 20th century, and its diminution in other periods.
What do you have any hunches to what that would be?
Well, I think there are a number of possible reasons, some of which are general, some of which are particularly peculiar to the Anglo-Saxon countries at the moment, which explain that disparity I mentioned earlier. I think the first thing to notice is that these sharp rises in inequality at the top end of the scale, the emergence of a small number of really big winners who then attract a lot of attention, tends to happen when you're getting major innovations in the way the economy is organised or in technology, which amounts in many ways to the same thing. And what you find whenever this is happening, and today it's things like IT, computer technology and science, artificial intelligence and automation, increasingly biotechnology and things of that sort. In the late 19th century, it was things like the electric motor, the advent of oil and all the products that could be taken from oil, the internal combustion engine. These kind of innovations are typically giving very, very high returns when they're first adopted. And so the people, the entrepreneurs who first adopt these innovations, first make use of them, the Rockefellers, but also the Zuckerbergs, if you will, the, you know, Steve Jobs of this world, they tend to reap enormous rewards because they have a first mover advantage. And so what you find during these periods of rapid and dramatic innovation is that a relatively small number of people who are in the right place at the right time, have the right personal qualities and insights, or maybe just plain luck, they reap enormous rewards and benefits. Whereas lots of other people who apparently have no real difference from the ones who've struck lucky, they're doing okay, but they don't enjoy these enormous benefits. And that's what they then start to feel a bit sore about it. So I think that's the main reason.
And that probably helps to explain why people seem to be just much more okay with the idea of an entrepreneur making a heck of a lot of money than they are with a shareholder or someone in senior management who sits on a board. This idea that it can't be luck that gets you to the top. You have to have some special skill. You have to have done something worthwhile. And so if you have those things and you get to the top, then it's okay.
Yes, I think that in the British case in particular, which I know something about, the British public seems to make a pretty clear distinction between the rewards that go to entrepreneurs like James Dyson or Richard Branson, which they're pretty relaxed about because they feel that this is actually payback for their genuine innovative creativeness on the one hand, and the rewards given to, you know, regular chief executive officers or senior company managers on the other, which they're simply not okay about, because they feel, and I think there is some basis for this actually, that in many cases the rewards are not justified in as much as they're not clearly correlated with success or contribution. There doesn't seem to be a clear distinction, they think, between success and failure in this regard. It's worth saying also that there isn't much resentment or opposition to high rewards for pop stars, people in the entertainment business, or professional sports and footballers. Typically, most of the people who moan and complain about the high salaries gained by particular footballers are either supporters of rival teams or, more commonly actually, supporters of the team the player in question plays for who feel that they're not doing a decent job.
Well, quite right.
You know. So.
But do you think part of this is the more negative connotation that's come around business recently? Because, of course, we know that FTSE 100 CEOs and top CEOs around the world can make or break a company. They can add billions yes. to its value, and they can also erase billions from its value quite easily. Sometimes the decisions they're making won't just make or break the company, but have legal impacts as well. They have a huge burden on their shoulders. So it isn't necessarily that these people don't have special skills. They're just not valued as much by the rest of society.
I think that's absolutely true. Part of the problem is that the running of very large, complex firms is something which is beyond the experience of most people and which most people have not that much understanding of. They don't quite realise what is involved in all of this. And I think that a crucial thing here is that the view of most people is that senior managers in large firms are basically functionaries whose job is to run an institution, whereas increasingly senior managers are seen by themselves and indeed actually are more like entrepreneurs. That's post Jack Welch and General Electric, that is the kind of model of the senior corporate executive, that they're disruptors, people whose job is not simply to run the large firm General Motors or General Electric in an efficient way and an even keel, but actually to constantly, regularly shake it up, be dynamic, to innovate, to be more like a startup entrepreneur, in fact, rather than the head of an established company. And entrepreneurs are the people who do, in fact, tend to get these very high rewards. And a second reason for why things are particularly prominent at the moment, and that is the fact that there are certain kinds of occupation where the distribution of income has a very pronounced winner-takes-all distribution. As you rightly say, if you think about entrepreneurial corporate executives, for example, there's a small number of people, a very small number globally, who can make or break a company, who can make a huge difference. And those people are in enormous demand, and they can demand a consequently very high salary. Similarly, in football, for example, association football, there's a very small number of players, the Cristiano Ronaldos and Lionel Messis of this world, maybe now the Kevin De Bruyne, as we would add to that list, who can really make an enormous difference to the performance of the team. But there's not many of them. And the trouble is that most of the time, you don't know exactly who falls into that category. Mm-hmm. As soon as somebody is identified as being in that category, they become tremendously expensive. Now, what that means is people, firms, football teams, law firms, filmmakers are constantly taking a punt on somebody, hoping that they are the next special person. And of course, in many cases, it doesn't work out. But what that does is to force up pay more generally throughout that sector. But the phenomenon that I mentioned earlier, of another reason for the phenomenon I mentioned, of a very small number of people at the top of the income scale pulling away from everybody else, is also the spread. And this, I think, explains why Anglo-Saxon countries see this more than non-Anglo-Saxon countries, is the spread of occupations in which a pronounced winner-take-all income distribution applies. That's true of law. It's true, above all, of finance. It's true of the entertainments and leisure business. It's true of organized sport. And increasingly, it's true of chief corporate executives. Now, in all but the last of those categories, you're dealing with areas of the economy which are much more important and significant and carry much greater weight in the Anglo-Saxon countries than they do, say, in Japan or Germany or most of the rest of continental Europe. And that, I think, explains why the gains shared by the 1% are much more pronounced in the Anglo-Saxon countries than they are in continental Europe or Japan, in addition to the more general global phenomenon of a technological shift taking place.
Do you think that history will be bound to repeat itself, and that the current anxiety around inequality will only go away when it is perceived to have been addressed? And do you think that's actually going to require something so radical as a maximum wage or a salary cap? Or do you think it's possible this could be done through other policies like redistribution, or even just improving productivity and wage growth at the bottom end of the spectrum?
I think this is actually a problem which will given time, sort itself out. I'm arguing that the main causes for perceived growth and increased inequality is actually the rise in rewards to a small number of people at the top, and that this is driven largely by the good fortune that some people have in the early phases of a technological transformation, in being early adopters of the new technologies or new methods. Now, what happens is that as those new technologies, new ways of doing things become established, more common, more widespread, the competitive advantage that certain people have from being early adopters is severely eroded. And so the returns in economic terms to those new technologies, those new ways of doing business or whatever, they start to become much, much less. And the result is that income differentials actually become compressed. And you know it's much more difficult for individuals to then make those enormous fortunes. And so that's why, although there are still plenty of entrepreneurial businessmen in the central part of the 20th century, they're not making the kind of enormous rewards that were made by the great tycoons of the Gilded Age. It's not that the environment's changed so much, it's just that the returns to the technology and the new methods are significantly less because they've become more widespread. And at the same time, what will happen is that gradually you will find that the incomes of the people in the lower phases of the distribution will tend to rise, because as the technologies are widely adopted in the productive process, what happens is that they make people who are initially less skilled more productive, and that tends to raise their income. Now, what actually tends to happen, I'm afraid, is this. One of the standard forms of social history is that concern about things typically peaks precisely at the point where the something in question is less and less of a problem. So what I would actually predict is that concern about inequality will continue to grow and will actually peak sometime after the growth of inequality has peaked. So I suspect that actually at some point in the next 20 years, we will start to see an end to the really big fortunes being made in initial technological adoption and lots more competition driving down returns on that new technology. But the concern about it will actually go on increasing for some time after that. And that's why, as I say, what you tend to find is changes in policy actually happening after the phenomenon that they were created in response to has already stopped. But that's actually a very common feature in history. Now, what you don't want to do in this context is to overreact by introducing policies like, say, for example, a pay ceiling or something of that sort, of a maximum wage, which would have disastrous results and would actually be extremely disruptive and very bad for the general working of the market economy. You might think about ways of dealing with the condition of the least well-off, the bottom 20%, and trying to improve their situation, and I think that's an important focus for public policy. What you should not look to do is to salve the irritated and envious consciences of people who are in the top 10% but are annoyed that somebody they went to school with is now earning 100 times more than them.
No, we shouldn't be catering to them. Last question, Steve, on the topic of inequality, but also a bit broader as well. To what extent is it reasonable or even good to try to address perceived unfairness, even if it isn't actually the case that something is fundamentally unfair?
That's a difficult question. The simple answer would be to say, well, no, you shouldn't do this. What you should actually do is try to persuade the public or the people who believe that there is significant unfairness that this is actually not the case. I suspect that that's a very difficult job for the politicians, though. I suspect that's actually more a job for literary figures, for writers, storytellers and people, filmmakers, rather than politicians. Because, quite frankly, cultural creators like that have much more say in shaping popular perceptions and understandings than do the politicians. The politicians are actually following on from that. However, it may be that that's actually not possible, and that what you need to do is to address the actual anxieties or concerns that people have. Now, I suppose in this case, you have to follow the political requirement of the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, and just make sure that whatever you don't do things that have the effect of actually ultimately making everyone worse off because of maybe destroying incentives for innovation, maybe making the economy work less efficiently. And in some ways, actually, symbolic actions of one kind or another are actually profoundly effective. Part of that comes by action on the part of the, if you like, the 1%, the fortunate 1% who've got these early adopter gains themselves, things that they can do that can, if you like, make it clear that what they're doing is something that is, by extension, creating general benefits for everybody. The kind of things Andrew Carnegie did towards the end of his career, for example. So he described in his famous semi-autobiographical works at the end of his life. That is probably more effective than any kind of public policy, given that what we are concerned with here is not so much a well-founded or real concern, but rather a kind of feeling of anxiety on or uneasiness about the rewards going to some people, and a feeling that, my God, surely they can't be justified. Nobody is worth that much. And I think the way to address that is not so much through policies, because there's a high risk that you might actually do something damaging and dangerous, but rather through symbolic action.
Fascinating. Thank you so much, Steve.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.